At the Table with Tony is brought to you by Trafe Hustlin'. That's www.traifhustlin.com. Your home for all things barbecue. Welcome to At the Table with Tony. My name is Anthony Sciglia, better known as Tony Mangia. And tonight, I'm excited. Tonight, I'm really excited. We have two guests on. So we have two guests instead of one. So it's going to be, we're going to have a fun night tonight. And I want to introduce my guests. We have filmmaker Robert Tennell and his wife. She's an author and historian, Shannon. So I want to thank you again for taking some time out of your schedule to come on the show. And first of all, I guess in a way, I'm late to the party because we're talking about the Feast of the Seven Fishes after Christmas. So this is kind of like we're getting ready for next year.
Yeah.
It seems for us the last few years, it's just all year round. Because it's like our job now, you know.
And I literally closed a bid on an online auction for a fish necklace for next year to wear. So I'm already planning for next year too.
Well, we'll get into the whole, because obviously you have a big festival down in West Virginia, you know, a couple of weeks before Christmas. We'll get into all of that. But there's a lot to cover tonight because there's, you know, we're kind of talking about West Virginia, the food of West Virginia. We're talking about the movie, The Feast of the Seven Fishes. So there's a lot going on this evening. And again, I'm excited for it. So let's dive right into it. You I guess a couple of years ago, you guys wrote I guess it was a comic book, right? A comic strip about the Feast of the Seven Fishes.
It actually started, I think I started it in 2004, to be honest with you. I had done a deal for a horror movie. And then the people were like, what do you want to do next? And I was like, well, this romantic comedy about my family cooking fish on Christmas Eve, which did not go over well. But I had just done my first comic book graphic novel. And one thing led to another. And I actually did it first as an online strip, an online comic strip. I was interested in the medium. And I mean, she thought I was crazy because who's publishing this? And I go, I'm going to put it on the internet and give it away for free. And she's like, are you nuts? But that's how we started building an audience. And the book came, you know, a year later. And again, every step of the way with this, people like didn't believe, or they would be like, why are you doing that? It doesn't make any sense. And like, no one wanted to publish the book. So we just created our own company, published the book, and then got nominated for the Eisner Award, which is like an Oscar of comics. I mean, on paper, none of this makes any sense.
You know, it's funny because I guess it had to be. So when did the book come out? When did the book actually come out?
The book, I think, came out in 2005.
Because I remember there used to be, I live in North Jersey, and there was a store up here called Chef Central.
Absolutely.
And if I'm not mistaken, you guys were there because I have a my book is actually signed.
Wow. So you got it from back. And those were fantastic. I loved doing this because so many people, dozens of people would show up.
Yeah.
And we would cook and talk. And it was my probably the most fun signings ever.
Well, I guess we should probably introduce people in case they don't know, in case they've been living under a rock for 100 and something years. If they don't know what the Feast of the Seven Fishes is, I guess the feast is. It's a celebration mainly by Italian Americans, because I think that we talked, I guess it was a couple of weeks ago, you made an appearance on the Abruzzese and the Molise Society out of Washington, D.C. They had a little talk with you guys, Ray Abruzzo, Paul Ben Victor. So you guys, you know, I think I had mentioned that not everybody knows or have heard, as Italian Americans, they don't all know what the Feast of the Seven Fish is. So can you first, I guess, explain a little bit about what is the Feast of the Seven Fish to you guys?
Well, I think I think what's important to understand is, and it's a point I want to make anyway, is that particularly like when I did the film in particular, I didn't want to come off like I'm some expert in this. I'm trying to take it, you know, from the perspective of a family who just does this. To be honest with you, we called it Christmas Eve. We just knew we had fish on Christmas Eve. The first time I was like 30 when I finally said to my mom, why do we do this? And what is it? She goes, oh, that's the Feast of Seven Fishes. But it's a Southern Italian thing, I think, because I'll meet people from Northern Italy and they go, there's no such thing. And then you kind of have to educate them that Italy's a little more complicated. There are people that live somewhere other than Tuscany. And, you know, I think I made the point on that show when I find it just amusing when people suggest that this is not an Italian thing, that it's an American thing. And I'm like, so 1.2, 1.8 million Italian immigrants moved to America in a time of no mass communication. Most of them probably couldn't read. They moved all over the country and simultaneously started serving fish on Christmas. And I just don't think that, I don't think it went down.
But it is interesting because I know that my and I think I might have made this point too on that program was that a lot of times the vigils of big solemnities of big Catholic holidays would always be meatless, so it would make sense that a lot of times they again, like you said, it was just Christmas Eve and it would be these meatless meals. So whether it was fish or whether it was some kind of a baked pizza. So mm-hmm. it does make sense that, again, being a meatless evening, most Italians, especially being, you know, if they were religious or they followed the traditions, they would be following this meatless festival.
Oh, absolutely. And which Shannon wasn't on that one when we did the Italian American podcast, and Patrick on there, really was blowing my mind with stuff I didn't know. And I want to be very clear. I didn't want to know.
Uh-huh.
Because that changed the authenticity of my story. If I come in pretending that this character in 1983 said, oh, we do this because of that. No, they didn't. They did it because it was tradition. They weren't overthinking this.
Yeah, exactly. And that is, I think that comes across great. I mean, really well in the movie. Because, you know, you're obviously, so let's talk a little bit about the movie. Let's get into the movie a little bit. So give us a brief synopsis or a brief rundown of, you know, who is the main character and kind of how it all plays out.
Well, it's Christmas, December 23rd, December 24th, 1983, which was a special year for me, although I didn't know it at the time, but it was the last year that my great-grandmother, Isabella Oliverio, was alive. And kind of the last time the whole family, everybody was alive and doing this thing in a kind of an innocent spirit. And it was an interesting time, you know, in American culture with musically and with MTV. And there was just a lot going on. And there's a young kid, Tony Oliverio, who is torn between his responsibilities or the expectations of his family and the family business and his dreams to kind of maybe step outside of that world and maybe pursue something not in the old neighborhood. In fact, not even in the state. And simultaneously, there's a young girl who is not Italian at all, who they kind of meet on a quasi-blind date, and she kind of gets dragged into the world of his crazy family's Christmas Eve. And so for her, it's kind of we kind of follow her voyage of exploration, or, you know, as she kind of is exposed to a completely different way of doing Christmas Eve. And I always loved this thought, and I wanted her character to say it, which is, you know, for a lot of people, Christmas Eve is like the most quiet night of the year. And for ours, it was like, you know, like a riot, like it's a train wreck breakdown. And I loved Christmas Eve, frankly, more than Christmas Day, because it was just so much fun. And that we were doing things together.
Yes.
And she is amazed at how there's just so much going on instead of sitting there, you know, quietly.
And the whole neighborhood would stop.
Oh, my God.
Your
yeah.
grandfather's yeah. house and visit. And so, the community came. It was nice.
Yeah.
So both of you grew up in the same town?
No. The same area, but not the same town.
Okay, so let's talk. So again, the movie takes place in West Virginia,
mm-hmm.
and when most people, I mean, let's be I guess I mean being a you know a New York Italian or a New Jersey Italian, we only think that there's only Little Italy on Mulberry Street, Arthur Avenue. You know, maybe we'll give Philly some credit here and there. Boston's North End, but we kind of forget that there are so many rich Italian enclaves throughout the United States.
My family was from Bloomfield in Pittsburgh. So
okay.
That's where my Italian family were from.
Again, I mean, I do a lot of like traveling on the weekends. So like I always grab my wife. I say, let's go in the car. We're going to find another Italian enclave. And literally, I mean, and I'm only going like in New Jersey every week. And I find these little nooks and crannies throughout New Jersey that have
rich Italian history, rich Italian American history. So I think that sometimes, you know, everybody says, oh, Brooklyn's the best, New York's the best. Yeah, it's great. But we have to realize that if it wasn't, you know, first of all, it was the hard work of the Italian immigrants coming over here trying to make a difference for their family. You know, and they settled wherever there was work. Mm-hmm. So in West Virginia, it was the mines, right?
Absolutely. Well, and the mills.
And timber, the mines, the mills, all of it.
Yeah. And I think that you raise a good point too, because in every once in a while, you know, I'll hear from someone saying, well, this wouldn't have been like that. And it's like, no, this wouldn't have been like that in your town. The people from my town, when they watch this, they're like, oh my God, you know, it's so precise. Because there is a unique, you know, it's not monolithic. There is a uniqueness. And that's what makes it so wonderful. And we talk, and she can talk way better about this than I can, but the adaptability and the, you know, I think I said this on that thing with you, the relatives of mine who taught me the most about foraging and hunting and fishing and kind of adapting off the land were not my dad's Jamestown, you know, 350 years they've been here people. It was my Italian side. Yeah. And they knew where to go find the, whether it was the pokeweed or the mushrooms or, you know, or my grandfather catching a giant turtle and then his mother making this incredible soup out of it, you know, just... You know, I mean, a lot of the fish we had on Christmas Eve were fish that he would catch during the summer and freeze, you know.
Most of the Italians all in the mining camps, they all had gardens. So, you know, they had to grow
and bread
food.
Ovens.
They had to grow food to supplement, you know, because you just weren't paid anything. And you had to buy everything at the company store. And what you couldn't, if you had a large family, you had to grow extra food. And so, I mean, all the Italians in the coal camps had elaborate gardens growing on hillsides, anywhere you could put something, they would grow something.
But you are right, because the Italian, I mean, not to say, I mean, obviously this is more of an Italian American show, so we're always saying Italian, Italian, Italian. But a lot of these immigrant groups, they had a lot of ingenuity. So they, yeah, like you said, they can grow tomatoes in places where you shouldn't be growing tomatoes.
But again,
like you said, Robert, they're going. I mean, I know for us, we have something. I don't know if you guys are familiar with it. We call it gardoon.
No,
it's from the artichoke family or the thistle family, and it's kind of a. I think it's more of a Sicilian thing, and you find it on the side of the road. So I remember as a kid, and the one thing about gardoon is that you never told anybody where you found it, because that was your spot, and if you told somebody your spot. Oh, then you know, all the Italians would be going there, and they'd be taking, they'd be, you know, in pit.
They call it cardoon too.
Cardoon. We call it with a G, gardoon. Or
I was like, I know of cardoon, but I don't.
Yeah,
know gardoon.
Yeah, that's the way we say it up here. Like gardoon, at the gardoons. But again, it's just, you know, if they had like, so I remember as a kid, my dad, he would take me to like upstate New York, and he would have his little patch. We would leave early in the morning. And he would go out there with the machete and cut these gardoons off. And he would come home, clean them. First of all, it would take you hours, and you get all the spiny things on your fingers. Mm-hmm. And then you have to peel it, boil it, and then you would fry it. But really, the end result was, mamma mia, it was amazing. It was amazing. So Shannon, now you are a food historian or a historian?
Local historian, but I focus a lot on foodways and. With the festival, I've always ran the cooking school. So every year we do a cooking school for about 100 people, and you sample 7 different dishes every year. And that's been sort of my baby, just trying to preserve these recipes for future generations.
So explain a little bit about the festival. So there is a Feast of the Seven Fishes Festival. Now it's in Fairmont?
Fairmont, West Virginia.
Okay.
Second Saturday of December.
Second weekend in December.
Weekend, yeah. The school's the night before on the Friday night. Saturday's the festival. It's a street fair in downtown Fairmont.
It's nothing fancy. It's literally, and it's like a holiday homecoming for the area. And, you know, people just, you stand in the street, you listen to music, you eat, you drink, you visit.
Eat, smelt, listen to polkas.
Yeah. And we always have polka at our Christmas Eve. And
polka?
Yeah, polka, it's a West Virginia thing here.
Really?
Yeah. We play polka music during the festival and always on Christmas Eve.
But what is the was it brought by another ethnic group, or what is the what's the history behind it?
Well, I do think that's part of it though, because these mining camps were like the UN. You know, I always say, like, I could walk out the street from my grandparents to Josephine Priolet's store at the end of the street and get yelled at in like four languages. and it was really, it was, and I think there was a lot of cross-pollination, but polkas were just, I don't know, in our house, I made a joke in the film. The kid says, we play polkas. He goes, they're like Christmas carols, except they don't have anything to do with Christmas. I thought Christmas carols when I was a kid, because I'm like, you know, it was Dean Martin and it was Frank Sinatra and it was polkas. It was not Julie Andrews. That was the next day. Not
I gotta be honest. I do love a good polka.
Oh
yeah, it's awesome.
Oh, I mean, we could say, but again, it's something about it. It makes you want to move. And I think that's I think that you kind of see that even in the film.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And we've had two musicians with us since the beginning of the festival, and they've sort of backed off a little bit because they've getting aged or getting older. But they, like, during the cooking school, in between me setting up the next person that's going to cook or breaking the other station down, they play polkas. It's like two guys. And
that's awesome.
Like, the audience just goes crazy. And, you know, you're sitting there drinking wine and eating and listening to music, all for $25.
Mamma mia.
You get your belly filled. I mean, you get a generous sample of everything.
So now when did the feast actually start?
This was our 15th year for the festival.
So I guess technically it's because the first year's year one. So I think it started 2006. Our friend, a businessman in Fairmont, Lou Spatafor, he actually came to me and he said, I think we should do this. And I instantly knew it was a good idea, but just like everything else, the movie, the book, the comic, people are like, why do you want to do it? It's not going to work. People are not going to go stand outside in the street all day
in the cold.
And it's like, these people drive 90 miles to Pittsburgh to the Strip District and hang out all day to buy baccalà and drink. Believe me, they'll sit out here if you give them something to do. And I remember when we did the first festival, about 10 minutes before, there was no one. It's like a ghost town. And my one friend, Jimmy, was like, he kind of yells at me across the way. And he's like, hey, Bobby, I did this because I love you. And I'm going to lose my shirt on smelt and this and that. And at 1 o'clock, I hear him yelling at me. And he goes, I sold out, and that was the beginning there. It was like the, if you build it, they will come. And people just went crazy for it.
So people come from all over?
Oh, now.
Yeah, now. Yeah, we get, like, there's one. I know there's people, they come from Chicago every year. Yeah.
And we have come from Pennsylvania.
Oh, my God. D.C., Baltimore. The furthest that someone has come is California, I think.
And it also now, I think, too, it gives people that are from the area but maybe live somewhere else, because it's the second week of December, so you have a little time before Christmas. And it's actually, now they schedule that as it's time to come home and visit and then go back and celebrate Christmas at their house. So it's a good time for all of that. And you get a lot of homecoming type things with it.
That's why I would love, I would. So I guess COVID this year kind of put the damper on it, correct?
Yeah. We actually kind of pulled together a TV show for it, because it's really important to us that it keep going. Like, her obsession is collecting and preserving the recipes. My obsession, quite frankly, is, and I don't think it's as bad as it was, but when we started it was like, you would hear people, when they talked to you about Christmas, it was like, I got to get to the mall. I got to go do this. I got to do that. I got to Martha Stewart this, everything. And it's all this pressure. And I'm like, when I was a kid, you actually collected memories more than presents. You had shared experiences. That's what I love about the feast, is this thing of doing together, that we do with our children and our nieces or nephews or cousin, whoever, you're doing things together, and we're not in the car driving around trying to get this stupid stocking stuffer or something. I mean, I think something's lost, and it has turned into, like Shan says, it's a real homecoming. It's a real.
And the new traditions that people have developed through all of this. I mean, I can't tell you how many people message me or want the recipe. I mean, I know 10 different people probably that now their big thing is to make limoncello. You know, I taught them how to make limoncello 1 year. And now, I mean, people have limoncello offs. You know, my cousin does quinoa, orange cello, limoncello. You know, he's become a master.
He's very competitive.
but I mean, so many people will get a hold of me and they're like, we do limoncello now every year. That's our tradition now. My neighbors down the street, the whole family comes over and they peel their limoncello. Like their lemon's very...
Precisely.
Yeah, I mean, I use a vegetable peeler, but theirs are like shreds.
Mike
will
probably end up watching this.
I'm like, hey, how thanks long for the does shout it out. Take that them to do that? But you know, every year they.
But you know,
it's a family thing now. They do that.
But Tony, I think that what's cool about this too, and we have to acknowledge this, is that we over the course of what is it, Shane, 4 or 5 generations, we go from Italian to Italian American to American Italian to American.
The sixth generation, I believe, you're American.
And you're not going to, you know, you're not going to put the toothpaste back in the tube.
Yeah.
Nobody wants to. But at the same time, and I say that, I mean it sincerely, and I say this, I try to say this every time. You know, some really brave people did some really brave things to get here, sacrificed a lot. You know, my grandfather 700 feet underground in a coal mine every day. I think it's kind of evil to not try to remember that or try to embrace them.
Well, and I think that, yeah, your ancestors are waiting for you to discover them. I mean, it's important to keep their memories alive. And I mean, we're only sitting here now because we came from strong people.
Amen. That is so true.
I mean, and you should honor that.
And, you know, and by the way, though, from a selfish perspective, you know, I can't be with them now like I did. You know, particularly, I was crazy about my great grandmother. Mm-hmm. My mom has a very different perspective, but my perspective, because she's like, because she was old, tired, and you were a boy, but I could do no wrong.
Yeah.
And learn so many cool stories and things from her. I can't sit with her, hold her hand, or do anything anymore. But when I smell that stuffed calamari in a red sauce, boom.
You're there.
Boom.
You know, people think, and maybe I'm the only one, but some people think I'm crazy because I actually like to visit the cemetery.
That's our hobby.
Yeah, I mean, because you know what? Besides, you know, visiting your family by going and looking at other names, then I do a lot of like this ancestry stuff. Mm-hmm. And then I start putting, I say, wait a second, that name looks, I saw that name at the cemetery.
Yeah.
Oh, I remember that name. Exactly. So you really start to put together the story of who you are and where you came from. Well, that's important.
This is, I swear, you know, you're Italian, you see a sign and everything, right? But this one time our son was having a lot of health problems, was at Children's Hospital in Pittsburgh. And it's right next to this enormous cemetery where your great or great, great grandparents were
My
buried.
Great-grandparents.
Great grandparents were buried. And one day she was just so stressed and our son was having some tests and I wasn't there. And she said, I'm going to take a walk. And walking through the cemetery, you tripped
and
turned around and it was her. That's how she discovered her great grandma.
No.
Headstones. But that's like a message, you know, that's like.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's just the Italian. I mean, I do more with the Italian stuff, but I know the Italians are with the messages and even like, you know, some of the superstitions like the Malachi. I don't know. Do you guys. Is it the Malachi down in West Virginia?
Well, that's why it's in the movie, you know.
Well, and I'm usually have my evil eye necklace on. I actually had my cousin make me one when my son with all the health stuff. And I when I'm stressed out, I put it on and it
kind of
yeah.
Now, okay. So I think that we talked about Robert. I think we talked about where your family was from on the other show. So they're from Calabria. Your Italian family's from Calabria.
Yes, San Giovanni in Fiore.
San Giovanni in Fiore. And Shannon, where is your?
My father's family are Abruzzese.
Abruzzese, okay. Yeah. Do you know what town?
Rocca Cinquemilia.
Rocca Cinquemilia, and what was the other one? I know like one of it translated to like Castle of Blood because we laugh because he loves Dracula. And I was like, you know, they.
Maybe like Castel Sangue?
Castel del Sangue.
Is that maybe?
Yeah. Because Sangue is blood and Castel is. So I this is great. So again, my name is Anthony Sheila, Tony Mangia. We are here at the table with Tony, being joined by Robert and Shannon Tunnell. I'm having a blast, you guys. And again, I want to thank you for being a part of the show. I want to talk a little bit about this. This is a great book. So I'm going to tell people, I'm going to put it on. I have my little banners here. I could actually posted on here. So go out and buy this book. This is Shannon's book. It's a culinary history of West Virginia from ramps to pepperoni rolls. So I know what ramps are, but explain to me, what's a pepperoni roll?
Well, it was, you know, it was created by an Italian miner, and it's really just pepperoni and a hot, like, Italian bread bun. And I always have butter on top of it. They're best when they come out of the oven. And it was mobile food, you know, so when the miners or workers were going to work, you know, and if you got trapped in the mine or were late, it had a long shelf life. So
it was preserved meat, you know, the way it was wrapped. But a guy named Cheech Argiro is from Fairmont, West Virginia, did the first one. They fight about it, but he did.
Yeah. Country Club Bakery.
In fact, our friend Chris Block still has it. The bakery's still in operation. Mm-hmm. The pepperonis were still amazing. I mean, there are other amazing pepperoni rolls in the area too. I mean, but it's just, it's an obsession here.
And they've went across the border. I mean, it's in Ohio now and southwestern Pennsylvania, but I mean, it really truly is. And it more so originally in north central West Virginia, it took a little longer, you know, to go to the southern part of the state and all of that. But it's everywhere now. I mean, it's synonymous with being a West Virginian.
So mine with sauce and cheese, by the way.
What do you do? You dip it or inside you put the sauce and the cheese?
You slice it and then you can put like provolone or mozzarella in it and then you can sauce.
And there's a whole debate of, you know, whether you're a sliced or a stick person, but I'm personally a ground person. I like to grind mine up in the food processor because you get an equal grease spot.
Okay, because I thought that I looked up to see what a pepperoni roll was on the internet, and it looked like it was literally like a stick of pepperoni in a piece of like dough.
The original one was a stick, but some bakeries do slice, and now some of them are doing grinding it up. So now my son, who's autistic, that's the only thing he eats that I fix. So I bake pepperoni rolls every day. He eats about a dozen a day.
Wow.
But it's just one of those things.
I'm taking some shortcuts now. Like I keep some Rhodes bread dough in the freezer now and take it out every day because it's, you know, to whip up a batch of dough on the whim is.
But I love, and I just love that's a uniquely idiosyncratic thing about us, about our people, about here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, we're people, I was saying on one of the shows, I never saw a round pizza in person till I was 7 years old. At a Pizza Hut that we went to in Roanoke, Virginia.
Really?
I saw round pizzas on TV, but all the pizzas I saw were like rectangles that you could put like in a shirt box. I never saw a round pizza.
Yeah, we grew up on
nice, big, thick.
And I'm still, I love a good Sicilian crust. He's more of a thin crust person now, but
no, I still like my cauliflower.
I like a good
thick. So a West Virginia pizza would be a thicker crust.
It was.
Yeah.
I mean, it's now like
traditionally that's what it would have been years ago.
In our area,
like Cala Cessna's, which is sort of the big, that's like one of our go-to places. That's just, it's really famous.
And from the town I grew up in, Tostillo's Pizza, they had big square pizzas.
And like I've mentioned earlier, Josephine Priolet, that she made it. She's passed away, unfortunately, but she made it at her little mom and pop store, Rosie Salerno. Or, you know, my great grandmother. I mean, the way she made it, it fit in a shirt box. Mm-hmm. But I mean, she did everything. My great grandmother cooked a feast of seven fishes on a wood burning stove in the basement of this pretty primitive little house she had. She did the whole thing on a wood burning stove.
And that's the thing. How did they do that? I mean, you think about it. How did they do that?
It was just tough, but again, we're talking about the movie, we're talking about the book, we're going back and forth here,
so it's kind of fun that way. But I did love, you know, the whole preparation scenes in the movie, you know, kind of, you know, draining the water for the bacala. I mean, these, you know, it was too salty last year, you know, things like, but again, it's true because, you know, Italians like to give a good dig here and there. And, so now these people were actually based on your family, correct? The people that, you know, the characters in the movie are based on your family, right? Right, Robert?
We shot in my grandparents' house.
Yeah.
So you still own the house or still in your family?
My aunt sold it, I think, around 2005, 2006.
We rented it back.
We had to rent it back.
It was very strange, yeah.
But thankfully, he hadn't done very much to the house.
Yeah. So like the wallpaper, and
the door banging into the chair, still banged into the chair, you know, which was great. I was like, wow, we can.
But now, so
you could. It was a very strange experience being in his grandparents' house shooting this film. You felt them all around you, and it was surreal at times.
So obviously it's a house. Are the house as big? Is it a small house? How were you able to film in a?
I'll tell you, and I was like kind of like, I'm not always the sharpest blade in the drawer. I mean, I don't know why it took me so long till my brother finally said, maybe we should just go look at it. But the reason it would work, now, if we'd have tried to shoot it where we originally used to have it at my great grandma's, would have been a disaster. Because seriously, in the basement, it's like a 7-foot, it would have been terrible. But my grandfather, it was company housing, so it was a duplex. And when miners started making some decent money, finally, in the 50s, late 40s, my grandfather bought the whole house, knocked it open, so it mirrored, right? And so the kitchen on the other side became this big bathroom. But so we had this extra room that we called the playroom. That's where the kids played. That looked right into the dining room. So I was like, well, if I do this, I know, you know, basically you're going to get a 25, 30 foot long space to get into work. But I mean, it was incredibly tight because you're looking at dinner scenes when there's like 13, 14, 15 people in there. What you need to understand, there's another 25 or 30 people on the crew over your shoulder.
There's a couple of pictures I have up here on the screen. I don't know if you guys can see it.
Yeah.
Well, I should have sent you the mural, Tony. I don't think I sent that.
I fixed the food. I did all the food for the film. And I fixed that about a half mile away.
Yeah.
And we literally would have to transport it to and from. And it was crazy. I mean,
have you seen the mural? I should find this.
Actually, I do have, I think it's, it? it's the background.
Yeah.
I haven't got a better one. I'm going to get my phone and send you, I'll send it over while we're on. Oh. Here, you can grab it, but they're doing a mural of this image in Fairmount that will be a part of the festival forever now. And
so Fairmount is what, just south of like Pennsylvania?
Yeah, like where we live now, because I left Los Angeles a long time ago, still work out there, but live here. I guess our house is about 11 miles from Pennsylvania, so Fairmount's probably about 20. I mean, you know, it's more like we're a suburb of Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
In a sense, you know, it's like 80, 90 miles, and really that's nothing. You know,
exactly. Yeah, actually, so. I have a friend of mine. He has a restaurant down in Fairmount, and I haven't been there yet. Rocco Muriale. Yeah.
I love that place. That's wonderful. It was interesting because I was talking to another food historian the other day, and he's from Cincinnati, and he goes, and he's working on some stuff with the Midwest. And he's like, well, what is West Virginia? Like, what do you think? How would you define it? And I was like, it depends. I was like, where we're at, we have very northern, you know, food ties and things like that. I was like, and then you have some mid-Atlantic stuff. I was like, and then you have the South. I was like, we are uniquely a strange place. Like, you know, you can't really define it because you have the way that it sets and the way it's bordered by these places, you know,
it's kind of like a crossroads.
Yeah. And the Mason-Dixon line, you know, runs across, and it's like two different worlds sometimes.
But that really is, that makes it for an amazing place to live, an amazing place to grow up, amazing place to kind of experience.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, it's, I mean, even like within like the West Virginia history aspect of it, I mean, you know, for example, the Civil War. I mean, we were the only state born from the Civil War, but also, you know, I mean, people literally fighting for different sides, you know,
and
you live in like each other's backyards, but you just, the difference of a thought process.
I just received the photo, so I'm going to see if I can upload it to the StreamYard here. As I do that, I wanted to. So let's talk a little bit about, I guess, film. So the film was filmed entirely on location in West Virginia.
Yes.
In Fairmount.
In Fairmount. We did one day in Morgantown, West Virginia. We shot some car stuff in Morgantown, but otherwise, yep,
So all these places that you filmed in, all the, you know, the restaurants, the Oliveri's fish market, these are all real places.
Yes. My family didn't have a market, but our friend, Richard DeMary, we're very close to the DeMary family, and that's an Italian market. It's been in the neighborhood, you know, since the 30s. And you know, people, it's just, it's really, we just grew up in a great place with a lot of great people. Like they just, they co-depend with whatever weird idea I've got, you know, they're just like, okay. And Richard was great about that. And, but you know, it's really funny now is now you've got what they call cine tourism. So there's all these people pulling up in front of his place. They want to get their pictures taken and then they go in and get a sandwich or whatever, or some of Richard's amazing sausage. And the one place, that's called Chicky Joe's in the film, we liked it. It was owned by the Riggi family, but we, we've actually bought that. We're actually operating a restaurant now.
Because, really? What kind of food is actually? West Virginia comfort food.
Well,
there's the mural. So kind of explain what we're looking at here.
And is that's not even the final one. I sent you the wrong one. Sorry.
Okay. That's okay.
It's even way better than that. It is a, it's being installed soon. Professor Joel Dugan, who's an artist, teacher at Fairmont State University, painted the, it's a 22 by 58 foot installation.
Wow.
With the idea that the, when you go up to get your picture taken with it, you know, you'll be there with the family, with the food, you know, being a part of it. I mean, it's just, I really can't. Like,
well, the food is a character in itself.
Yeah, like very much.
In the film. I mean, you know, it's really, you know, what for me, the festival and everything is about are those traditions, keeping them going. And, you know, I mean, we're already preparing our daughter. She knows how to cook the most all of it. We're like, you know, one day, well, I have told her, I was like, Christmas Eve is always ours. I was like, until we're too old to do it. I was like, you can have Thanksgiving, you can have Christmas Day. I was like, but you're going to be here on Christmas Eve. But yeah, already teaching her what to do. And
also, and not being too rigid about it, you know, because again, I think it's important that the togetherness, like about the last 4 or 5 years, somebody brought something to the festival and heard. My father-in-law, Larry, and I got into this. Like now, amongst every other thing we do, now we grill oysters. Now, we always had oysters on Christmas Eve, but now we put them in the shell on the grill, and we hang outside, drink beer, drink wine, and shuck these oysters. While all the other food, we didn't give anything up, because we're like the feast of about 225 fishes now. But you know, it's like we have so much fun.
Well, we do.
Even if it's snowing, we're outside.
And my tradition is we do something traditional every year, like the fried smelt or the, you know, stuffed calamari. We do one or two of those super traditional things every year. And then my tradition for myself is, because I like to play in the kitchen, I cook something new every year. I try something different, get out of my comfort zone, try to get creative.
She made a new one. That one that you made, she made a dish that I've never had before for this cooking show that we just did. I don't want to keep looking at my phone or I'd send you a cool picture of it. But what was it, baby? Was it whiting?
It was sort of my take on bacala, because, you know, we didn't have time, you know, with the show and everything. So I was like, well, I want to do some type of cod recipe and talk about the importance of salt cod to people and all of that. But it was cod with lemons and herbs and potatoes and olives baked. One sheet, easy, stick it in the oven, walk away, come back. But also, you know, I try to do accessible things for people. And I try to do things that people can stretch their money with families and feed a bunch of people. Because he'll always say, he's like, well, we didn't have a lot of pasta. Well, you know, when you have 50 people for Christmas Eve, you got to have some pasta to make some food go.
Yeah, that's true. I didn't get a chance to read the whole book yet, but I did notice that I guess the pasta that was popular in this area, or in West Virginia, was the quitada style?
Quitada style, yes.
Yes.
So is that something that was kind of like, you know, that was brought over from where, from Calabria?
That quitada in the beginning of the, you know, in the beginning of the film when she's making pasta, my great grandfather made that guitar. That's the pasta I ate as a child was made on that.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Where is it, honey? Is it upstairs? I should bring it.
It was over by the.
And maybe I can get a dog to quit being obnoxious.
We're going to have to let him. Yeah, but yeah, he bought me one because we didn't get that one.
No, we didn't get that one until we did the movie that my aunt gave it to me, or my great uncle, I guess. Gave it to me.
So what was it like
for myself growing up, like when I would go to my grandmother's, my father's bedroom, she turned into a drying room for pasta. So when you would
really
get, like, dinner, like there was just pasta hanging all over my dad's bedroom. We always laughed about that.
I'm gonna send you a couple more things while we're sitting here, because these dishes that she just made, this one I thought was so cool. And this was this that I'd never had, which is kind of like a cod with potatoes kind of a dish. So I'll send it along. Maybe you enjoy seeing this.
So what would be your traditional feast of the seven fish? What would be your traditional seven fish that you would be eating on Christmas Eve?
We always have fried smelt. We always have stuffed calamari.
Stuffed calamari in a red sauce, and also without the sauce, just with oil and cheese.
We always have anchovy pasta.
Okay.
Whiting, usually whiting fried like in a, although someone, I think it was at Chef Central, because I kept meeting people and we kept trading recipes. And they turned us on to a whiting salad, which is like whiting with
red onions
and celery. And then you kind
really?
Of, and then it's almost like, and then just kind of a lemon vinaigrette sort of a dressing.
It's very light.
Very light. It's fantastic.
Do you guys do skunjil down there?
No, we have. Did they do it one year though at the festival? Somebody did.
Robert may have. I can't remember. I mean, we've done everything at the festival. We've taught people how to clean an eel and cook it. That was an interesting year doing eel for 100 people.
We haven't done eel here for a minute. But yeah. We got hooked on baby octopus.
Oh, I think that's the picture. Yeah. I think I clicked the wrong one.
Look at the food on the table, though. He just totally nailed it. He took pictures from our table at home and started putting that stuff in there. And I don't know about everybody else's family, but I was like, dude, you got to put some tangerines or oranges or clementines
nuts.
Or something.
Yes. Yes.
Nuts.
Oh, yeah. You always had to have the nuts.
Well, and I think like both of us, our whole childhood, there was always an orange in your stocking. And until our kids were, I mean, we don't do it so much now, but when they were little, there was always an orange in their stocking, because that's what my dad did. And that's what his family did.
I think St. Nicholas used to give out the oranges.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of plays on the whole St. Nick. So what was it like then to film in your hometown? Was it, like when you're filming, like your buddies from high school were saying, oh, Rob, what's going on?
Oh, like set security, Shannon was with friends at our friend Bernie's wine bar here. And at one point, they're like, so is this like a YouTube video? The cast of The Sopranos doesn't come down for a YouTube video. But it was weird because, familiarity, I guess, breeds contempt. And because we live here and everybody sees us all the time, there's no like, oh, Hollywood, they don't care. But like, I would literally be on set directing and people would just... No one would stop them and they'd say, I'm here to see him. And they would let him in. And I'd look up and there'd be like my friend Vince's mom just wandered in. You know, I hadn't seen her in 30 years. And, you know, what do you say?
People would just wander in. And then we had an offsite at the community building
in Reeseville.
And people would just show up and hang out and like the stars and everybody were there. I mean, it was actually nice, but you just never knew who was going to walk through the door.
My favorite, I won't swear, but we had to stop traffic for something. And, I'm always very, in addition, I'm always worried about safety, but I was like, I was super grateful. And they had brought in some auxiliary, like police people or someone to me. And I recognize this guy's face, but I don't remember his name. I'm just trying to be pleasant. Walking along, and I'm like, hey, really appreciate you guys. Thanks for doing this. And he goes, it's a bunch of BS is what it is, Bobby. Man, there's a I get no love here. You're just a kid from the neighborhood. Nobody cares. But that's what I love about this.
Oh, because the traffic delay.
He just didn't want to be out in the cold. I think he just didn't want to do it. You know?
I was able to upload. Let's see if it's just taking a little bit of time. Oh, here we go. This dish looks amazing.
Oh, so good.
Yeah, that looks like outrageous.
Where did you find that?
I just sort of thought it up.
So that was just something that you just kind of said, okay, this will go with the cod. This is gonna
I read recipes for relaxation, and in our house, living with an autistic adult, who's very noisy at times, it's hard to like really stay focused and engrossed in a novel. So it's a lot of like recipe reading, and I just take bits and pieces of things I like and put things together. Like, in, I don't know, I'm blessed with knowing how flavors work. So I'm glad about that.
Well, I know we have friends though who do a bacala potato thing. My family didn't do it. My immediate family didn't do it, but.
I think Italians have a way, again, I keep on saying Italians, but I think that we have a way of kind of making something out of nothing a lot of times.
Well, and that's what the Patrick from the Chinese American podcast.
Maron, look at that. Look at that crab.
Well, you know, it was funny. You know why I picked the crab was, you know, because of COVID, I couldn't get anything. Like, I wanted to do like something that photographed well.
Like a big red snapper or something. Couldn't get it.
Couldn't get anything. And we didn't have time. We didn't have time to get the order in to spur all that. So I saw them at the local grocery store and I was like,
really?
I'll play with these guys. Yeah. And I'm always trying to do stuff because when you're here, and even when I do the cooking school, like we're a mobile cooking school. I never know where I'm going to be, which is interesting planning food for 100 people when, you don't know if you're going to be in a tent, a church. We've been how many places?
I think we've been 6 or 7 out of 15 years.
We cook on induction burners.
This was from the TV show that we just did with her.
Oh wow! So what are you making there, Shannon?
There, I think I'm making the Calabrian chili oil
for shrimp. Oil.
Yeah.
So now, is there a way that people can get your recipes? Do you have a website? Your Instagram?
Well, I mean, I always am putting food pictures up on Instagram. I'm working on a collection of things for a book right now, but there are recipes.
There are recipes in the original graphic novel, but she's just gone so far beyond it. There are a handful of like local recipes that were either my family or friends' families that are very sort of local to here. But part of the thing about doing book tours and things is, man, I got turned on to so many, although sometimes it's really funny. I keep going back to Chef Central in Paramus, but I met this really nice lady. I met really cool people there. And she's like, you know what you should try? And she tells me this dish, and it's very simple, but I've never had it, which was sauteing anchovies in oil and garlic. And then you take a slice of bread, put provolone on it, and then melt the cheese with the hot anchovies in oil.
Ooh.
And I tell my mom goes, oh yeah, we used to do that. I'm like, well, why did we stop? This is like the most amazing thing ever. And I try to do it on the morning before we start really cooking. Whenever I can, I try to have that first.
Yeah.
For me, anyway.
And a lot of the dishes I try to like put together, like when I'm doing the cooking school or just doing like Christmas Eve here, like I figure out what he's going to cook or like with the cooking school, what the other chefs want to cook. And then I sort of fill things in, I let them pick first. And because I always try to have a balanced menu to where there's, an appetizer, a main dish, dessert. Sometimes we even do a drink. So looking to where, and also like with here, looking like, because they're on the grill, they're deep frying, all the burners are going. So you try to like pick recipes with, well, I can stick this in the oven, like the cod dish, and really utilize your workspace so that everything comes out at the same time.
So the chefs that you get, how does it work? So can anybody sign up to be like?
Every year I'm like I have seven. I cook every year, and it's we've had professional chefs, we have home chefs, we've had family demonstrations, we had the Italian society at
we had the gentleman from I forget where he was from, like Florence WVU, or someplace, but he was here. He was in grad school or something. But he did a pumpkin tortellini, and it was incredible. You know, sauce. And it's like, why can't we share these things?
You know, how does it work then? So somebody says, okay, I want to cook for the feast. Is that how it works?
Or kind of like, what's the out and cook with us? Yeah.
You should come.
Oh, I would love that. I'll come down with Pat O'Boyle.
Yeah. Pat would be, well, Pat's coming.
Oh, good. All right. If Pat's going, then I'm going to come.
Yeah. So what I do is usually like all the chefs will get their own ingredients and you prepare a generous sample, like, you know, 2-3 ounce sample. And we prepare usually for 100 people. We usually have about that many and a little extra because we feed like the people working and stuff, the volunteer. But I set you up. We have a kitchen right now that we've been at the one local church for the last 3 years. So we actually have like ovens and like a sink and things like that. And you cook, you demonstrate in front of the crowd while we're serving your dish. You demonstrate.
Oh, okay.
And so I have two stations usually set up, and when one person's done, the other person comes on, and it's
very a train wreck, but it's awesome. Wreck, yeah. It's a train wreck,
but that's what makes it fun, I'm sure.
Oh, it's well.
People wander into the kitchen, you're like, hey man, we're trying to work.
Well, we wanted it to feel like you are at our home on Christmas Eve, so we like it a little chaotic and messy because that's just sort of that's the way that it is, But yeah, we usually have some music in between, and it's just a good time.
So, Robert, you sent me a couple of behind the scenes photos from you when you were shooting the movie, The Feast of the Seven Fishes. So I'm gonna put them on the screen, kind of if you can give us a little bit of what we're seeing here.
Well, I'm there with I can see the director of photography, Jamie Thompson's right beside me, and my AD Phil Rush is behind him, and in the distance my good friend Porter Styles, my fraternity brother, who does he's like, I can talk him into anything. And we were shooting, we were about to do some night exteriors, I think. It wasn't quite dark yet, but we were setting up, or maybe it was daylight, I can't remember, to establish where Josh Hellman as Juke is kind of telling this story of the community. And so we were actually shooting outside the restaurant, A Street Confectionery, which is now our restaurant.
Now this is your grandparents' house.
That's my grandparents' house. Yeah.
Although now the shed,
it's fake.
It's fake.
It's fake. We had to build it.
Actually, our contractors who work here doing stuff with us are good friends of Bob's from childhood, and they that was their contribution to
like, yeah they
got a credit in the film. They came and built the shed.
Jason Baker's the production designer. He's like, I need help. I'm like, let me get these guys, because the shed that I was sort of basing
Willie
it on
was
actually at the next door neighbors, and it just visually would have, well, it burned down. That story too, which may or may not have involved friends and my other brother.
We'll leave it there.
But I will say this: when I talk about our families helped, her dad, my mom, my brother's sister,
my cousin,
nephews, niece. I mean, every people just pitched in. Our
it
friends,
was a family and community
thing. Effort, and my brother Jeff was a producer on the film. But then, oh, that's us at the wine bar. We took the cast.
Bernie's,
our friend Bernie Vasquez's wine bar. That's the cast. That's our daughter. Our daughter's in the film. She's the girl that doesn't feel well at the bar.
But, oh, the underage girl?
Yeah.
Phyllis. But my producers, John Michaels and Scott Woody, both, because they are from California. Well, John's from Cleveland, Scott's from Canada, but they both live in California now. But both of them, multiple times, particularly the night of the church sequence, where they would say they were blown away at how our community would come, because, you know, to have 150, 200 people show up as extras, you're not paying them. And they go, but they'll never hang out. You know, I'm like, yeah, they will. And they did. You know, they were tailgating. I'm not going to lie. My friends were outside the church tailgating.
So can you... Can you give us some stories about the actor? You know, obviously Ray Abruzzo, great actor.
Oh,
yeah. He's a real cat. You know, he was like amazing in The Sopranos. It's just his character is hilarious. Kind of a totally different guy in a way in his movie. You know, he always had a cigar in his mouth. So can you give us some like a couple of behind the scenes stories about some of these great actors?
You know, I mean, part of it was just getting them was the most incredible thing. You know, I mean, I never dreamt. I mean, I had hoped that we would have some recognizable, you know, well, I wasn't going to settle for bad actors, but I was hoping, you know, the two or three roles deep, we'd be in good shape. I never knew we'd be 9-10, you know, with names. And I mean, people like, you know, Andrew Schultz, who was an up and coming comic, and now he's got a huge Netflix special. I mean, he's blown up, who plays Angelo. But, you know, but I mean, outside of that, I mean, you look at this cast, you go through it. It's just, they're some of the finest character actors working in the world. You know, Joey, Paul, Victor, Ray, Lynn, the late Lynn Owen, who we miss and mourn terribly. I mean, and then, you know, and I cannot pretend like I was just the cool guy who had everything figured out. I never dreamt that I would get this young cast. In my mind, I was like, I'm going to get some older character actors. You know, no, I didn't know I was going to get the kid from Santa Clarita Diet and the girl from Jumanji, you know, or Addison, who is just absolutely incredible actress. I mean, Addison, Skylar, Josh, our new discovery, Jessica Darrow, who plays Sarah, who I think is going to be doing big things. You know, and then for the lower, you know, down the cast list, people that didn't have to work as much. We did a mix of finding people like Tony Bingham and Jean Zarzour, who Jean actually ended up moving to the front credits because she was such a huge part of the film, who plays Mary, plays the grandmother. But we actually cast non-actors in places, you know, who were just, because I knew they could do it. Like I said, my friend Porter, he just plays himself in the film. I said, just be yourself. Just be.
I was supposed to be a bartender, but then I got a call. Well, one friend wants to do it. I was like, all right.
So you got pushed out this time.
I got pushed out. Yeah.
But you know, I think the whole thing started though, was getting Josh Hellman, who plays Juke and who is for me is a pivotal character.
Because, like you said, I think you had mentioned earlier that he kind of does tell the story in that one scene of the history of the Feast of Seven Fishes in this particular town in West Virginia.
And he's like, cursed with self-awareness, which a lot of people don't have. And so he's aware. He can see the chess pieces. He can't necessarily see it for himself. But it is. And I relate to Juke. I'm not Tony. I'm not that nice guy. I wasn't that good of a dude. I sure was not that evolved at 21. but Juke I related to because he remembers everything, he mythologizes everything, he knows how the pieces fit together, and he's a bittersweet guy. And when I saw Josh's audition, I was just floored. I mean, he's from Australia, you know.
Wow, you wouldn't think.
He's in Mad Max Fury Road, right? I mean, he's Stryker in the X-Men movies, the younger Stryker, you know, and then now he's Juke, and he's this like, you know, like Cary Grant looking movie star, but he puts on a toboggan. And
well, and I think for me, like, I love that character too, because I think like with having a special needs autistic son, there's, you know, to me that Juke character is a little bit like my son. He's on the spectrum, but he sees everything, but can't get it out, you know, but he's sees and knows everything that's going on, and he, you know, if you could just be in the mind or whatever. So that was bittersweet for me watching that character when everything was finished. Like, I mean, that was very touching. It's hard for me to watch at times.
But again, I mean, really the cast you had, they were perfect for this role, for the roles that they had.
Yes.
Yeah. They're very,
and just
very
wonderful,
happy.
Wonderful people. I mean, just very kind, and it was a pretty good work environment.
I mean, we've heard from most everybody that it was the most fun show they ever worked on.
You know? Really?
Yeah, and because on the weekend we would go out and have these big meals.
And we did teach my dad and I did teach Ray how to make pepperoni rolls.
Really?
Ray's so involved here now. He's like the godfather to some friend of ours.
Child.
No.
Yeah. Because he started meeting people, you know, in town, and he, you know, he was here for how many weeks, and he just became good friends with this family, and now he's the godfather of their son.
So how long did it take you to film the film, to film the movie?
It took us 18 days to shoot the principal photography, but I did 19 days of second unit. I mean, whether it
was,
I can't remember how many days of food we shot, but every time it snowed, we did things. I mean, there are shots. I put something, I was going to put it up on Christmas. We had a white Christmas. It was beautiful. And I went out at one point and I took a shot with my phone. I should put it up. That I needed a shot, a transitional shot for those montage sequences. And I shot the street light and then a tree at the end of our driveway. And we ended up putting them in the movie, you know, because it just worked. So we were always doing things like that. And
pickup shots. He got in trouble a couple of times.
I got in trouble for trash in the kitchen.
Well, we would have to do food pickup shots here. And I had just got a new brand new stove. But they wanted to shoot the cookies rising in the oven as they baked.
Yes. Yeah. Okay.
So they had the oven temperature up to 500, as high as it would go, but had the door open. It melted my knobs off.
No.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I was like, I just got that stove. But we did a lot of, you know, like.
Well, my brother and I got like 1970s Matchbox cars, and then we would go shoot them on blue screen and shrink them down because we needed cars. And you say, well, if you could have come to us and said, here's 100 cars from the 70s and 80s, who's going to move them?
Yeah.
Where are you going to get this time?
Yeah.
You'll never know, but there are like literally.
Wait a second. So some of the cars are Matchbox cars in the movie.
Yeah, not the ones they're driving.
No, but you were. I wouldn't even that you told me that. Now I'll have to look for it, but I wouldn't even know that.
Yeah. Listen, I keep telling people to try to recreate the 1980s required 305 special effects shots for this film.
Really?
And that's more special effects than I had in the first four movies I directed. And those movies were about Merlin and Excalibur, the Frankenstein monster and Dracula, a plane crash or an air disaster, and a ghost story.
Really?
All of the effects in those movies, we had more movies and more effects in this.
Now here's a behind the scenes. It was actually snowing or?
Yes, it was snowing and on and off. And
made snow too.
We didn't have to make snow this night, thankfully. But this shot was really special to me because Alex Saviak, who drew the graphic novel, I learned a lot from him about visual storytelling, working in the comic book space. And he drew this shot for when Juke does the phone call and, you know, engaged, you know, and then then Alex just did this wonderful shot, high angle of Juke going out the street with this street lamp. And it really made me think about different framing in sort of a daily comic strip that I hadn't thought about. And I was always grateful for Alex for that. And I wanted to make sure that of all the images in the film, that's the one that's really a callback to the book.
Hmm.
So this was a special moment for me doing that particular shot.
So now
the cold moment.
Yeah, it was cold.
Now the book, is it still available? How could people get a copy of the book? Amazon.
Although okay. it is running out, and I suspect we're probably going to have to make a decision at some point, because the movie's very helpful.
I actually have. Oh, I'm going the wrong way. I actually have two copies of the book. So I have two copies. And even in the book, so now the recipes in the book, Shannon, these are your recipes or how did...
They're a combination. There's some of like his family's recipes and mine. And that was like the very beginning. Like, you know, in a lot of things, it's hard for me to write a recipe because I don't measure anything. So when I really have to, like, people were like, well, how do you fix that? And I'm like, hold on, I got to think about it. It's a pinch of this. And that's, you know, so when we were trying to reconstruct, like, his grandparents' recipes, it really was, I would fix sauce until he'd be like, that tastes like my grandmother's. And so, you know, I've come a long way with writing recipes since those ones were first done, but it's still very hard for me to write a recipe.
But I think about it.
I promise to myself every day that, you know, when I'm cooking today, I'm just going to take notes and write things down, and then I never do.
But really,
there's a lot of good recipes in the West Virginia book.
Well, the West Virginia, but we were talking about the first feast book.
But yeah, really, the West Virginia
book is a combination of everything. I mean,
when people like Italians, when they would cook the old school, you know, the nonnas, the grandmas, they, like you said, they never measured. It was a handful of this. But what do you mean by a handful? Is it my handful? Or is it nonna's handful? So they don't equal.
No. Well, and there's always funny stories too when you really research recipes and family traditions or whatever about how many people would leave one ingredient.
Oh, out. I was just gonna say that. I was just because they never wanted to be one-upped.
No, see, and I don't do that. Like, I truly always I love to share recipes because I love to share food. I mean, to me, food is love, and it's the easiest way that I can express how I feel about someone is to feed them. And so when people ask me for a recipe, I give them like the true recipe. I don't admit anything.
But like you said, I think food in a way, sharing a meal, breaking bread is a very intimate act.
Yes.
Because you think you're sharing a meal with usually the people that you love the most, that you care about. And even when you cook, it's funny, like, sometimes, you know, people say, you know, you go to these amazing restaurants, these expensive restaurants, and the food just isn't the same as the food that's made by grandma. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's, I always say, is it the oils in the hands when Nonna's picking up the sugar? Yeah. It's amazing, really, right? Think about that. Think about how food tastes different when different people make it. Even if somebody feels angry or they feel a little perplexed, you could almost taste it in the food.
Well, and I never bake if I'm not in the mood. I'm not a great baker anyway. I only usually bake at Christmas and at Easter, mm-hmm. except for like pepperoni rolls. But like when I do my pizza piattas, I'll wait until I'm in that mood because I know if I don't, it's not going to be good. And so
what's pizza piatta?
Well, that is a traditional Calabrian Christmas bread that we fix here in West Virginia. But it is a wine yeast dough. It's like the best dough in the world. And then you fill it. You have to make the filling ahead of time. So it's chopped walnuts, two large oranges, raisins, and then your allspice, cinnamon, and brown sugar and white sugar. You let that set overnight, or at least for like overnight to 24 hours, and let all those flavors come together. And then you make the dough the next day, which is yeast, wine, melted butter, olive oil, and a little pinch of salt and some allspice. And then you fill that dough, you roll it out, and it has a really beautiful sort of purple tint from the red wine. Mm-hmm. And you fill it with that nut mixture, and you can make them in little rosettes, or you can do a roll, and you bake them. And that is, it's a very common Christmas thing here in North Central West Virginia.
But Robert, you said that most people that settled in your town were from Calabria, right? In Fairmount?
And almost like primarily from one town.
Yeah.
From San Giovanni Fiore.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean,
but we have friends like my friend Demas is there, yeah. Sicilian. I mean, we have there.
Well, there was one town in Tucker County, like in Thomas, like that was like, they specifically brought like a large group of Abruzzese Italians there. They had an Italian newspaper, but they all came for the timber industry.
I mean, we had it, and it's in the film briefly, but when I was a child, on the radio, and the show just went off the air not long ago. My friend Nick Fantasia, but his dad, Nick Sr., had a three-hour show called The Italian Hour. And when I was a kid, it was in Italian.
Yeah. Really?
So when we had family dinners on Sundays, I heard everything. Because I remember they did the I Want to Hold Your Hand in Italian.
Yeah.
And I just thought that was the coolest thing, you know. But yeah, I mean, and the show was completely in Italian, and then it was 2 hours in Italian and an hour in English. And then I think, and then eventually, you know, towards the end, it was just English. Yeah, that show was on, my God, almost 60 years.
But a lot of, you know, the older Italians would not speak Italian, you know, because they wanted the children to Americanize and, you know, blend in. And
so, we could cuss.
A lot of, you know, you lost a lot of that because it just wasn't taught. And
what? Was there a second wave in the 50s and the 60s, or it was only the initial wave of immigration?
I'm not very conscious of that. What I do know is that when I was in the 60s, when I was very young, my great-great-grandmother passed away in Italy. And I know that my great-grandmother's sister and a bunch of my cousins, like they all picked up, the whole family just picked up and moved to BC, to Victoria, you know, outside of Vancouver.
Really?
They would come and see us. And like when I lived in LA, they'd come to see me. We were actually
but,
close.
You know, and a lot of Italians that immigrated here during the Industrial Revolution, they're, you know, a lot of them, their goal was not to stay here permanently. Their goal was to come here, make money, and be able to go back and feed and support their family. Mm-hmm. Some stayed, some went back, but it, you know, we're obviously, you know, from the ones that stayed, but you know, it was a different sense of, you know, immigration.
I haven't said that, you know, I just realized that, but Rena Potesta, who is in, she's the lady in the, with Nani in the church scene, and they're saying mm-hmm. nasty things about the girl in Italian, but you know, she moved here in the late 50s. Because her son and I, her son's one of my oldest friends. In fact, that's really funny to direct a scene with the woman who, when you were a kid, actually beat your ass. And that did happen once.
Really?
Danny and I were little and we did something. Back. We were like five and we threw dirt clods at a house or something. She lit us up and then my mom came and I got lit up again. And they came because, and I know Danny, I think went back and spent a year and went to school.
But I think they had family that had been here already.
Something, yeah.
Yeah, I don't think that there was any like large amount of Italians that came here during that time.
But I know when I lived in LA, I had a lot of cousins out around Pasadena. And when I would visit with them, I know they were still, people were still coming over.
Yeah, I know, like, you know, like obviously New York, even New Jersey, there was that, we call it the second wave of immigration. You know, it was in the 50s, kind of like right after the Second World War, up until about the 70s. But now it seems like there's even this third wave of young professionals that can't find jobs in Italy, unfortunately. They're coming to America to, you know, kind of, again, find a better way.
Well, I think what happened here, too, is mining became very mechanized.
Yeah.
Right. So where you used to have tens of thousands of mining jobs, you don't. You know, that stopped.
Is there still mining or no?
Yeah, but it's nowhere.
I mean, it's definitely phasing out.
A lot of surface mining and a lot of these big, you know, like they're more down the southern part of the state, but there are still some underground mining.
Huh.
I mean, well, my youngest brother just was a miner up until 2 years ago. So.
Wow.
But, you know, it paid really well by the end, you know, not in the beginning. I mean, when my grandfather went into the mines, he went in, there were horses and they were, the horses were like blind
because they never
saw daylight.
They never came out.
Wow.
They even lived down there.
And the horses?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Now, I know we're kind of going over here and we'll wrap it up after this question, but you mentioned something called a company. Now, what does that mean for those that don't?
The company owned the mine.
They
owned the store. They owned the housing. They provided the medical. So if you want to see a great film and get a sense of it, watch John Sayles' Mate One. If you haven't seen that film,
what is it, John Sayles?
Mate One. MATEWAN. It's based on a true story about mine wars here in West Virginia, which is a fascinating time and place. You know, when literally, you know, kind of the U.S. government bombed its own people because of labor issues. Yeah, you don't hear it. They don't even want to make this place a designated site.
Yeah.
Wow.
Still, there's that much pushback. But yeah, I mean,
the Battle of Blair Mountain.
You need a pick and a shovel to dig coal. That's great. You can get it at the store. Once you've paid it off, you can take money to, you know, eat.
And you
so you would have to buy your own pick and shovel?
Yeah. And you could only shop at the company store
because they paid you with script. They paid you with money that was only redeemable at the company store.
So it was just a perpetual cycle of...
That's why I would get frustrated sometimes when I would try to describe that the feast was in many ways... I was trying to talk a lot about the immigrant experience. And I had one person in Hollywood say to me, stop saying that. You're embarrassing yourself. This isn't really about immigrants. And I'm like, you're embarrassing yourself. My family went through a lot. You know, a lot of families went through a lot.
Yeah.
And... put up with
I mean, the largest mining disaster in the history of the United States happened in our backyard in, you know, 1906.
Yeah.
Monongah,
where I went to high school. They know 400 and some
400.
People, but they think there were children working in the mines that they never.
Because you at that point, you were paid by the ton, how much you dug. So you.
Guys would bring their kids in to kind of.
Other people in to help you get your.
More tonnage.
Tonnage for the day.
You know, so I'm blown away right now because I, you know what, being from North Jersey, New Jersey, you know, you don't know about the trials and tribulations that our other, you know, immigrant brothers and sisters went through when they came here. And this is like, this is actually, give you a little, you know, a little upset about hearing these things. Oh, it's amazing how much.
And my great-grandfather, and that's the funny thing, I know there was some tension because my great-grandfather's brother did not come here, went to Brooklyn, and I believe had a shoe repair place or did something with shoes. And I think, you know, did well. Mm-hmm. We have no connect. I don't know if he had kids. I know nothing other than he came once to visit in a really big car. This must have been in the 30s. And I think my great-grandfather wanted to just, you know, kill him, you know, because he came down showing that he was doing better, you know. I mean,
well, you know,
that's not the only story I've heard about that. We want to make sure that they had a bigger car or whatever.
Well, that's why we, too, we try to always, you know, West Virginia gets a bad rap in the media. And, you know, I joke with him. I'm like, you know, we're really the only people you're still allowed to make fun of, you know, because anyone can make fun of West Virginia people. And it hurts you because, you know, the people that you come from and the people that have sacrificed and what we have been through as a state. Mm. And what we've provided, you know, for the country.
Well, it's funny. I was giving
we've had more military service than I think any state
per capita crazy.
Than any state in the union.
And it's a complicated place, you know. And it's always the Hatfields and McCoys, which is fascinating and incredible. And hundreds of miles from here, we're not from there. We don't have any relatives there. It's not us. I mean, I can literally walk out the back of this room, throw a rock, and hit a sushi bar and a gourmet wine place. I mean, I don't know what to say. We got indoor plumbing here. But it was the thing that I do think is frustrating and why we tend to get passionate too about the mining thing is, and I said this, I gave a talk at Lincoln Center after they showed the film and people wanted to talk about mining.
Mm.
And I was like, I just find it amusing that all these sins of mining are from West Virginia. When I'm driving through a city that, does anybody in New York know how to turn out a light? I mean, come on. I mean, you didn't burn any coal? Are you kidding me? And we see this throughout the Rust Belt. Okay, we see it in places like, Manesson, Pennsylvania, which,
no,
you know, built this, and Clareton, Pennsylvania, towns that made the steel, Youngstown, Ohio, that made the steel that won two world wars and set up Detroit. And now that you're done with them, it's like it's a nuisance.
Yeah, you kind of just
discard
it. Yeah.
Oh, wow, terrible. This? Oh, look how terrible this looks. Well, hey, nice person with a nice place in Connecticut, you got to have a nice place without pollution because a whole bunch of people worked really hard under terrible conditions. I mean, and it's okay. It's not your fault, but maybe you own a little bit of that. Maybe a little gratitude for the people who laid it on the line.
And people that are still laying it on the line.
And still laying it on the line.
You're right. I mean, I think that's the thing. I mean, even you know, the new immigrants that are coming and doing these menial jobs, even you think about, you know, how our food gets to our table. You know, people, you know, I guess it's one of those poorest communities, I guess, in America is a community in like California where they you know, a lot of them are immigrants that come and they pick the tomatoes, the whatever, you know. It's just, you know, we have to sometimes, I think, step back from our, you know, from our well-to-do lives or from our 21st century lives and say people are still sacrificing for the American dream.
Absolutely.
Still sacrificing.
It's like, if you want to get my mother started, you know, you start anti-immigrant stuff and she just can't take it because she's like, I can't be that hypocrite.
Yeah.
Because of being a hypocrite.
Because I mean, really think about most people that live in America today have ancestors that were immigrants.
Well, pretty much everyone in America is an immigrant. I mean, you know.
No, but here, you know, we talked about this on another show. Like, I have a friend, a prominent Italian American judge, and he was showing me or telling me about the deed to the one house he had that said the house could never be sold to a black, a Jew, or an Italian. That was written in the deed in the 1920s. So, you know.
Even in the town we live in now, I mean, the neighborhood we live in, that was a part of.
That was a part of
it. That was a part of it. You couldn't buy a house if you were an immigrant here.
Really?
And even, you know, in West Virginia, we have like the New Deal housing, you know, Eleanor Roosevelt, all of that, and you couldn't get into one of those houses if we're an immigrant. So, you know, they took poor white coal miners and gave them another chance, but not if you were an immigrant. You didn't get that chance to get out of poverty, because really a lot of that poverty stuff during that time was based on what was going on at Scott's Run. When Eleanor Roosevelt came here, she couldn't believe the conditions of how people were living, and started these homesteads, you know, to give people a better chance. And so there's Arthur Dell and Eleanor, and what's the third one?
The ones down in Tiger Valley. I can't think.
Again, stipulations on that. You couldn't be, you know, you couldn't be African-American or ethnic born.
There's that other old, there's an old song, I guess it's what, Tennessee Ernie Ford, 16 tons.
Absolutely.
Is that based on mining?
Yes, absolutely. And wow. This isn't just West Virginia, by the way. I mean, this is Kentucky and Virginia and Southern Ohio and, you know, Pennsylvania. I mean, it's, you know.
Well, there's that town. I know we're kind of going off topic here, but this is actually fascinates me. There is a town in Pennsylvania that they say is they had to actually evacuate the people because
it's still on fire.
If you're talking, what, 30, 40 years ago, and the town still, and the underground is still on fire.
Yes. It'll never go out, I don't think.
Well, we're talking the other day. I mean, he remembers because he is in southwestern Pennsylvania. My family were more mill workers than coal miners. And his whole childhood, the whole hillside, the whole slag hillside was on fire. Like, they just watched it burn. I mean, there's days that they can't go out of the house and really walk because the air quality is so bad. They give you advisories.
But again, like you said, do people in North Jersey know about this? Do people in New York City know about this? No, nobody knows about this because for some reason we don't like to talk about things that make us feel uncomfortable sometimes.
Yeah.
Well, especially once we escape, you know, and you ascend to that next level, you know, I don't know.
Well, we should end the show on a positive, on a high note. and again, I really do appreciate your time this evening, Robert and Shannon. This has been eye-opening for me because I've been learning about stuff that I would never even know. I mean, I have a couple of books about the Italians in, I guess it is that area. You mentioned it, not Muska.
The Monongahela Valley?
I think I actually have a book. I might have it here somewhere in my library about the Italians of that area. There were Italians in that area, right?
Oh, my God. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah,
the
yeah.
Largest, I think it's just about the largest Italian celebration in the country is in Clarksburg on Labor Day weekend. I mean, it's incredible.
Italian Heritage Festival.
Italian Heritage.
Really?
Huge. Huh. Like 100,000 people. I mean, we get 10 to 12, 13,000 people at the Seven Fishes Festival. This thing is, we don't want to be that big.
Well, that's a week.
Yeah, it's basically a week. And it's important. You know, it's important that this happens.
So now, how could people get in touch with you guys? Your websites, Facebook, Instagram, stuff like that. What's the best way to get in touch with Robert and Shannon?
You know,
Instagram,
probably. And, you know, honestly, because the whole film business has changed. I mean, you know, 20 years ago doing a movie, I wouldn't have wanted to engage with the public. You weren't supposed to. There's supposed to be a mystique. I'm making a concerted effort to respond to every single person that's kind enough to reach out to me.
Like you did for me. I appreciate that.
I had some fella, I don't even know how he went. I think he went to our website for the production company, which is AlleghenyImageFactory.com or WeBuildStories.com. I think you can somehow they got through to me. A guy did, and he sent the nicest email. And how am I not going to respond to that? I mean, who am I? You know what? We love hearing from people, and I find it fascinating that a lot of times what people really want is not to tell me what they liked about the movie or anything like that. They want me to listen to them talk about their experience. And I love that because it has enriched my life. I mean, we were talking about Pat. I learned so much. He's brilliant. I learned so much from him, but things that I didn't know. And to be honest, didn't want to know going into the movie because it would have really messed with the authenticity if I went in like some sort of an expert. That's not the point. Now, we do a sequel, I'll be coming at it very differently. From the perspective now of someone who's become quite, you know, hyper aware. But no, yes. I'm at Robert Tennell 1 on Instagram. She's at Shannon Coliani Tennell at Instagram.
And how could people watch the movie?
right now it seems like the, where I'm hearing from everybody is they're finding on Amazon.
Okay. Yeah, that's right. You know, I watched it two or three times on Amazon.
Yeah. And you can, and I encourage people, and the only reason I encourage people to consider buying the DVD or the Blu-ray is there are some really cool extras.
Oh, really?
Yeah. There's a pretty cool little making of behind the scenes documentary that we did. There's some footage of my grandfather and my uncles in it. There's a short film I did that's just kind of neat that's with it. There's a lot of photos and things. So there's like extras.
How could somebody get the DVD?
Amazon.
Okay. Amazon. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yep. And again, you can get Shannon's book at Amazon as well. That's where I got it. I got it last week.
And the Arcadia, the publisher, Arcadia website, you can get it off that. And
in West Virginia, it's like in like Barnes and Noble,
Giant Eagle, or local grocery store. Like
that the comic, the book can kind of getting low on stock, I guess, right?
Very much so. Especially if you can find the first edition. I'll tell you this little story that it drives me crazy, but now it turns out it makes it collectible. There was a mix-up with the first edition. When it was uploaded, for some reason, our art director person, that something happened and it defaulted to the uncorrected version. So the comic strips were all okay. But like at the time, I mean, I didn't know how to spell things in Italian that we do. They're messed up. Like I was trying to spell like Testadora, you know, because
yeah, that's it.
I didn't know how to do it yet, or like they've got a character at the last minute. I changed Tony's name, but in the text of that, so it kind of makes them. If you get the first editions, they're kind of collectible because they're messed up.
Yeah, I think
people don't even know, but I think it's funny.
I think I have it says second printing, so I must have
you've got the.
Hold on, let me see.
Nah, that's a second edition too. It's got a different flip cover.
Oh, really? Okay, so that's how you know.
But
It says first printing, September 2005.
Well, then that might be it, because they have new dust covers on them that talk about the movie and the...
Yeah, because this one does say soon to be a major motion picture, but on the inside, it says...
you lucked out.
First printing. There it is, right there in black and white. So I have one of each.
That's awesome.
I have one of each.
I hope you'll come and I hope you'll sincerely consider coming and
you can cook.
Cooking.
Yeah. No, I would like I was telling you before, I really enjoy, you know, visiting these little known Italian enclaves, Little Italy's, and really I make it a goal of mine to kind of whenever I can, you know, just try to, you know, visit. But I know it's a little bit, I guess you guys are about 8 hours from New York.
Is it quite that much? It's, I guess, maybe 6.5, 7. Yeah, probably.
So I know it's hard for me and my wife to go there, you know, for like a day trip. So it would have to be, you know, like an overnight.
You type cook thing. Friday night, and then Saturday you relax at the show and you have a good time. You go back Sunday. Sunday you have lunch at Muriel's, and then you go home.
Exactly. I have to give Rocco a shout out, because he actually, for Christmas, he sent me, he has three shirts that he has with the logo on the back with the hands. And he sent me one of each of his shirts. So I appreciate that from him.
Yeah. Well, see, it's a done deal. You gotta,
I have to come.
You have to come.
But again, Robert, Shannon, I want to thank you so very much. I mean, really, we talked for an hour and a half, and it felt like, you know, we could talk for another 3 hours. But I really do appreciate your time tonight. And, you know, God bless you what you're doing. This is amazing stuff. And Robert and Shannon, really, I appreciate you guys for taking your time out tonight.
Thank you so much.
It was fantastic. Thanks.
Again, I'm Anthony Scilia, better known as Tony Mangia. This is At the Table with Tony. I hope that you enjoyed watching this episode, talking with Robert and Shannon, Feast of the Seven Fishes, talking a little bit about West Virginia, the culinary history of West Virginia. What a great night. Thank you for tuning in. We'll see you next time. Ciao for now.
At the Table with Tony would like to thank its sponsors: Rocco Muriale, Rob Quick, Joseph Cirillo, Raymond Guarini, Tom Gilmore, Oli G, Peter Ziza, Brian McGuire, Peter Ferreira, Rich Ottenstrauer, Anna Mavrianos, Antonio Pepinella, Anthony Ferraro, Sandra and Bob LaMotta, Mike Guero, the Italian Enclaves Historical Society,